Welcome to The Filibuster, the podcast of the Union University Political Science Department. I'm Seth Brake, visiting assistant professor, and I'm here with Sean Evans, the chair of the department. The filibuster refers to the right of unlimited debate in the U.S. Senate. And talking about debate, we're here fresh off of experiencing a pretty uninhibited and unlimited debate that we saw last night. We just saw the presidential debate, and so, Sean, thank you so much for being here with us. I might have a few questions for you after that experience.
Well, sure. Fire away, though. I might follow the Harris-Trump strategy and not answer your question, and rather answer what I want to answer.
Well, feel free, but I think we'll know what you're doing there. Well, you know, the first question you got to ask would be who won, but I think I don't even have the information to properly understand the answer to that question. So before asking that, can I just ask you what you think the candidates wanted to get out of this? Let's start with Trump. What did Trump want to get out of this?
I'll start with what the Trump campaign wants.
Okay, yeah.
Because what the Trump campaign wants and what the candidate wants is not always the same. I think from the Trump campaign's perspective, they wanted to define Vice President Harris. She is unknown. Yes, she has been vice president, but many people do not know much about her. And I think what they wanted to do was say it's the Biden-Harris administration. She cannot escape the past 3.5 years. She's not the candidate of change. Trump is. I think he wanted to point out that she does not have policy positions. And the reason she doesn't have policy positions is because that she is a liberal extremist, and that if she said what she really thought, which they'd say she did in 2019 when she ran for president, the public would reject her.
Okay. Well, that makes sense as a series of goals. What do you think Harris wanted out of this?
I think Harris's was a lot easier. She is the unknown up against a former president. I think she had a simple plan. She wanted to show that she had the knowledge and the competence to where people can picture her as president. And I think she cleared that bar. Well, now, okay, you gave me this. Okay, why would this be important? Because it's not just what they think, but it's how we relate to them. And so that persona is going to be important. And for the lesser known candidate, it's always important to indicate, I have what it takes to be president. They want people leaving the debate saying, I can see her sitting in the Oval Office behind the resolute desk making the important decisions.
So both candidates in this debate, both of their goals were centered around defining who Harris is then, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I think part of what she was also trying to do was trying to reach beyond her base. She wanted to try to reach middle America. And so I think that's why she tried to bait Trump on some level so they would be reminded of who he is and what they don't like about him. I think it was also about the idea of I'm younger, I'm the new generation of leaders, and it's also I'm happy, he's angry, and I have a vision, he just runs down the nation. If they can provide that kind of contrast, they think that's a win.
Do you think this is unique for Trump to be in a conversation where he's not the subject?
I think Trump wants to be the subject of every conversation because he's something of a narcissist, and that's what gets him in trouble.
Sure.
I mean, I look at this debate, and I have to ask myself, if I'm a Republican, I have to be asking, can't you at least spend a little time preparing for the debate? Because there were several opportunities he had to say, here's where I'm different from the Biden administration. All he did was says, here I am different. He could put in some statistics about here's what the economy was like in my administration, in growth rates, stock market growth, GDP growth, inflation, compare that directly to the Biden-Harris administration. And also the idea of everyone knew she was going to try to bait him. And the key thing was, can he control himself? And as we know, Trump is typically his own worst enemy.
But it sounds to me like you're saying Donald Trump would have done a better job if he was focused on policy, had a lot of good information, brought statistics. You're saying he would have done better if he wasn't Donald Trump.
Yes. Well, okay. And so here is the thing. He's got his base. His base is not enough to win.
Right.
And so the question is, can he change just enough to get those people who are not happy with Biden-Harris to vote for him? What we saw in the 2022 elections was people who somewhat disapproved of Biden, a majority of them voted for Democratic candidates for Congress.
Right.
And the simple response to this is, how, if you disapprove of Biden, can you vote Democrat? And that's because Republicans nominated crazy, i.e. they nominated many Trumps, and that's not what they like. He needs to convince people he can change just for 56 days until he wins.
Well, if those are the goals of the two candidates, then can we assess the outcome? Do we know who won?
Well, I can say this clearly. The American people did not win. The American people did not leave this debate with much knowledge about Harris, her experience, her skills, her policies. She spent a lot of time prosecuting Trump, less so trying to define herself.
Okay. So that means she largely failed in her primary goal then.
Well, except she cleared the bar that she is presidential material.
Okay.
And that she tried to appeal to the middle. But I think there's a lot more that she could have done.
Yeah.
I think if you're a undecided voter, you did not hear what you needed to hear to say, I will vote for Vice President Harris. According to Snap polls, they showed that more people thought Harris did better than Trump. That's no surprise. And we saw where her favorability increased by 6 and unfavorability decreased by 6.
Okay.
But we saw no change in who do they trust on the economy, who do they trust on immigration. And these are the top two issues that most voters are talking about. And that's where she fell short. So, yeah, did she come across better? Yes. Is she going to get positive coverage for the next few days? Yes. Is this going to convince many people to vote for her? No.
Okay. So achieved a few of the goals, the most basic and perhaps most important goals, but not the overall electoral benefit goals.
I think she passed the minimal qualification goal. She didn't convince people to vote for her.
So then let's talk about Trump's goals. Did Trump succeed in any of his?
No.
Hmm.
For the reason was he passed up opportunities to talk about his record and her record, to talk about people eating cats, the size of his rallies, and other things. His best part of the debate was in that closing comments where he said, you had 3.5 years to do this. Why didn't you do it? Boom! Why didn't he start off with something like that?
Yeah.
And he could not do it. Or the first question, are you better off now than 4 years ago? Harris skipped it, talked about biography. Trump should have said, you probably know she did not answer it because the answer is no, and here's why.
Yeah.
And so the problem with having your best moment in the closing comments is people have tuned out by that point.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's only two options here for explaining Trump's behavior then. Either he just really messed this up and this was a weak performance, or he's going for a goal that we can't identify. I mean, do you think it's possible we're missing something in Trump's strategy here, or is this just an error?
Well, okay. Let's make a distinction between what the campaign wanted and what Trump wanted.
Fair enough, yeah.
And I think from what the campaign wanted, it fell short. Compared to what Trump wanted, I don't know what he was thinking.
Mm.
The thing with Trump is he's controlled by his impulses and emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So that even if he had ideas about what he wanted to accomplish. I think he got off track. It was clear that he was flustered,
mm-hmm.
And he responded in, to a certain extent, in an angry tone for most of the debate. And I don't think that's how you want people to see a potential president, as angry, lacking self-control, focused on myself, not on what the public is thinking.
Now, at a couple points, Harris seemed fairly aggressive. Do you think she avoided looking angry?
I think that's what we're going to have to find out. There historically has been a concern that there's a double standard for women, mm-hmm. that if they act like males and be an aggressive, it sometimes backfires against them. In this case, her campaign has talked about she's going to be the prosecutor, and I think we saw that she had some planned lines, that she had some planned strategies, and she followed through on that. I will say that the way she responded at times, in terms of laughing and smirking, that might not go along well with some people. And as we found out last night, some of our students thought that she came across as condescending, mm-hmm. and that's also not how you want to be perceived. And to a certain extent, if more people think that, that's a problem, because a lot of the people in the middle think the elites are out to get them, and if you come across as condescending,
sure,
it's the idea of you're just like the people we dislike.
No, that's probably a big part of how this is the interpretive frame that people are going to run this through. But you mentioned the fact that we watched this with students last night. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, did you notice some of the same things I did about that group, about the way that they reacted to this debate? It seemed like there was a lot of emotional engagement with what was going on. I mean, we were sighing and cringing and reacting, and people were laughing and responding. You know, do you think that this is the way that the American public was mostly responding to it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that there were debate watches all across the country, and most of these were partisan. The Democratic Party debate watch, the Republican Party debate watch. Union has a fairly conservative campus. We all know that. So it has a pro-Trump tilt. But I think most people are going, especially when they're in a group, they're going to react as a group.
Sure. And
I think they reacted the way a lot of Americans did, that there were some things talked about they cringed at. There were some funny lines. Mm-hmm. They laughed at that. And I think they also expressed the idea that they never answered the questions. We didn't get the information that we wanted, which I think, especially if you're undecided voters, that's the case. And remember, our students, they may be Republican in nature, but they're young. They haven't made up their mind about everything.
Yeah.
And so they could be more open to persuasion than diehard partisans for that reason.
Well, it did seem like we had a wide variety of reactions to the debate in our discussion at the end.
Yeah.
So I think you might be onto something there. But in terms of the debate as really an entertainment product, you know, is this something that you think is new? Is this something that's changing? Or has this always been baked into the debate process?
I think debates have historically always been infotainment. We have to remember that debate started back in the 1820s with the rise of mass-based campaigns. Remember, up through about the 1820s, the nominees were chosen by King Caucus. Members of Caucus would say, here's who we think should be our nominee. That broke apart in 1824. Going into 1828, we saw the rise of mass-based political parties, which coincided with the rise of the Second Great Awakening,
mm-hmm.
which used songs and tent meetings and torchlight parades to bring people to those tents. Parties adopted some of those things, and part of things is they had music and they had debates, and it was something when at night people were after farming, they're tired, they don't have TV to watch, they would go to these things and be entertained.
And now we can get them with TV.
Yes, but now I will say that this is probably something that changed in the post-World War II period. We saw a move toward professionalization. We saw a move toward objective journalism. Mm-hmm. And so we saw this idea that debates are supposed to be a different thing. And so they were more about policy and ideas. This doesn't mean that there weren't planned one-liners. Of course,
yeah,
there were. But the debates were more substantive, civil, but yeah, there were good lines in the debates.
Yeah,
I think, you know more about debates, so you should weigh in on this. But I think potentially polarized politics means that you can say stuff and get away with it because people aren't going to abandon you for that, and we have partisan media, which is going to say whatever your party wants it to say, one way or the other.
Sure. Well, and you mentioned the lack of policy, you know, in the way this is discussed. Maybe this is a return to form. Maybe we are going back to the previous era of debate. But it did, you know, you talk about this, thinking about this as a debate rather than as a political process. It did occur to me that the way that they were making their appeals seemed to be very different. They were talking about two very different things. Yeah. It seemed like neither one was selling a package of policies, just at the end of the day. Trump was selling a person. He was selling his personality. Because when he would talk about, like, for example, he said he was going to end wars, right? Two wars, you know, and his plan for doing it, he never said, well, here's how we're going to negotiate. Here's what's going to be on the table. He said, I'm going to make a phone call and solve it.
Yeah.
Right.
In 24 hours. So I think he is selling a persona. He's also selling a narrative of American decline, which he will reverse. That's the whole idea behind MAGA. Mm-hmm. America great. Again.
Yeah, but I think it's very important to MAGA that it's MAGA WT. It's MAGA with Trump, right?
Yeah.
It's Trump that will make America great again because he is the only personality who can do it, which is why it doesn't really matter what his policies are because he's the one going to think of them. I mean, there were the one of the lines that students said that they remembered more was when he said, well, he doesn't have a plan for this yet, right? He's going to come up with it, right? For healthcare.
Yeah.
But that really is the essence of his claim. I don't even see that as a weakness necessarily because he's not running on policy anywhere. He's saying, I'm going to come up with this because I'm a good leader.
But you see, I think that's also where he falls short because his personality is so polarizing that it makes it difficult for him to reach people beyond his base,
right.
And it makes it more difficult for him to convince people that what he is doing is in their best interest.
Sure.
And so I think, yeah, he is selling a persona, but I don't necessarily think it's a winning persona.
Right. But on the other side,
we'll find out if that's the case.
Well, yeah, that's true.
6 days.
This is one of those nice cases where something gets tested immediately, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think Harris was selling a package of policies either.
No.
You know, she was selling a demeanor and a set of ideals. And so, you know, we have a personality on one side and a set of vague ideals on the other. Neither one is proposing necessarily a set of policies. And I think that's why the debate felt so disjointed because they weren't actually debating what they were pretending to debate. And from a debate perspective, I think that's more what we saw that last night. And it's why even when it seems like they're talking past each other, they're really not, because it's a question of, do you want Trump the individual to solve all our problems, or do you want Harris's set of ideals to solve all of our problems? And that's why her appeals could say things like, if you don't like what Trump represents, then you can vote for our party for me as a candidate, even if you don't agree with my policies. She made that appeal in the case because she's saying you can stand with these ideals even if you don't like the policies.
All right, so as debate coach, is that what you want your students to do? Is selling a persona?
Well, you know, usually not. But the interesting thing about debate is that debate is a collection of tools and strategies. And you do have to understand your audience when you're in debate. And I think there's a chance that Trump and Harris knew exactly who they were talking to that night last night when they were making these appeals, because Trump thinks that there is a large audience of his supporters out there who are absolutely motivated by his persona, and that they'll turn out for that. He might be wrong about that, but you know, I think the bigger error might be on judge analysis rather than in debate strategy, because or on policy strategy itself, because I think they both correctly intuit that the average American is not making a decision based on policy, and so they understand the game they're playing. Now, you know, the debate, I think the places where they were violating what I would call good debate norms would be the way that they addressed each other. Debate thrives in an environment of mutual respect, because then you can see past the debaters into the issues, and there was obviously no mutual respect here.
Yeah, we were helped in that endeavor by two participants, Ryan Wagey.
Oh, that's right. Yes,
and Nick Truitt. They went through and started collecting all sorts of statistics, and one thing that they collected was the number of insults toward the other.
That's
Trump
right.
Trump insulted Harris 53 times. Harris insulted Trump 44 times.
Wow. Well, that's a fairly close margin there.
Yes, but okay. So yes, mm-hmm. But doesn't this have an impact on politics in a broader yeah. sense when they engage in a substantiveless mudfest?
Yeah, I mean it's a reflection of who they think we are.
Oh, don't say that.
I'm just afraid they might be right.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to give the American people a little bit more credit.
Okay.
With this, I mean it goes back to what Key wrote a classic article in the 1950s called "The Voters Are Not Fools."
Mm.
I mean, the basic argument made was that maybe individuals themselves don't make great decisions, but the group as a whole does make decisions. The idea they may not be paying enough attention to everything to know what the policy positions of everything are, what the strengths and weaknesses are, but they're able to look at key things and decide, is the party in power doing well
yeah.
or doing poorly, and make decisions based on that. And I think it's also the idea of, we want to respect our leaders.
Mm-hmm.
We think our country is great, and we think we deserve better than what we're being offered. And I think if someone would try to rise above that, that becomes important. I also think, and maybe this is just me in my optimistic manner, I think we want people to have solutions for us. I think we want to know that we are behind something bigger than us to try to improve the nation, and I think we missed a good portion of that.
As you say that, and again, I want you to be right about this, but I think back to the 2016 primaries, and the candidates who challenged Trump on policy and the candidates who talked about character did not do well against Trump. And it was the people who escalated and who adopted his strategies who lasted the longest.
Yeah, okay. Okay, but we're looking at the Republican Party
sure.
nomination. And
yeah.
I think what we have to remember is that the parties have two different political cultures. The Republican Party is a vehicle for conservative ideology. And populism has been running through the Republican Party for decades,
mm-hmm.
starting with Barry Goldwater. And part of that natural idea is that the establishment is selling out the grassroots. And so when you have George Bush's, the war, which did not go well, the financial crisis occurred, we ended up bailing out the huge corporations, less so average Americans. I think there is a visceral reaction among a lot of people in the Republicans to where Republicans had fed this idea that if only we stood firmer in our ideas, we would win, which is contrary to our constitutional system, then we would be success. And they had built that up enough to where Trump could tap into that and say, I'm not like these other people, and
mm-hmm.
appeal. But remember, Trump didn't win a majority in the 2016 primary.
Mm-hmm.
It's only over time that
sure.
he was able to take control of the Republican Party.
You know, you talk about that populist movement that fueled him. It's interesting to me because you take this back to Barry Goldwater, but I think in my perspective, when I look at the populist movement, it looks to me like it's part of the global populist movement that was sweeping through Europe and South America at the time.
Yeah.
That, you know, I see this as something that happened. There were Trumps all over the world, you know, and obviously America has a lot of political importance. So that, you know, Trump, we name the category after Trump, but he wasn't the first. And he wasn't the, you know, he wasn't even the most bombastic.
Yeah, so, I mean, we have to acknowledge that America has a long history of populism.
Yeah.
I mean, just in this century, Huey Lewis, what am I saying? Huey Long.
Yeah.
George Wallace, Ross Perot, Pat Buchanan. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Trump well, is all in that line. And I think we have to remember is, populism thrives because the system is not responding the way it should.
Well, and this might be the subject of a future podcast too, because there's a lot to be said about populism and how it works. Because yep. I think there's a populist movement in both parties that yes. is the predominant force at this moment.
Right, and the thing yeah. also is, in historically, populism tends to be from the working class. I think a lot of this populism is from the ideological donor affluent activist class.
Well, yeah, and that's. Perhaps we'll have to chase down that yeah. rabbit trail in the future.
So,
but yeah,
let's switch and get your debate
sure.
Per perspective here as the debate coach at mm-hmm. Union.
Well,
what were the debate strategies of both people that you saw?
I think Harris showed the most calculated strategy in this debate in that she understood that she could gain control of the narrative if she had the initiative. So she would say things when she would get a question on an area where she was vulnerable, she would make a comment that she knew Trump couldn't pass up. I think the most naked and obvious example was the little jab at rallies where she said, you know, your rallies aren't that good anymore and people leave early. And she said that in the middle of an immigration question, right? Where that was where if Trump was doing what I would expect him to do, which is to emphasize his strongest points, which is what you want to do in a debate, right? Instead, he got distracted. And what she was able to do was recognize his lack of focus on the outcome of the debate. So in debate, debaters get distracted by their egos. They get distracted by their opponent when really what matters is the ideas and the judge. And in this circumstance, I think Trump made that error in letting Harris goad him into that. And it wasn't just a matter of making him waste his time, which it did. It made him waste his time. It also, there was opportunity cost in that he couldn't emphasize his strongest issues. Mm-hmm. But I think even more critically, it gave her the initiative and it made it look like she was in charge of the round. And in charge yeah. of the in charge of the entire debate process. So I think that's the thing that happened where, you know, yeah, all this other stuff matters, but I think that's where he lost control. And I think Trump thrives when he's in control of the conversation. And when he's not in control, we saw what we saw last night. And again, this doesn't say anything incredible for what Harris did, because what did she do with that advantage? Well, she just kept jabbing and, you know, she made similarly petty responses. So I don't think this is an area where she used that and then used it as a vehicle for something great. But what it did was it derailed everything Trump wanted to do. So from a debate strategy perspective, Harris was inside Trump's head in ways that I think brought the whole debate down. And if she had used that to then emphasize, you know, ideas or policy or something like that, maybe we would come out of this saying, wow, Harris had a really good debate. But instead, we just saw this train wreck where she exposed a vulnerability in Trump and then set everything on fire.
Okay, well, let's ask you about how do you think the moderators did? Because they have also got a lot of attention. So how, I mean, in most debates, you don't have moderators,
well,
right?
Yeah.
So what kind of role do you think that they played and how did they impact the debate?
Part of this comes down to the fact that what we actually see in these things, it's not technically a debate. This is a town hall format. They're responding to questions in sequential questions with each other, and then they get a chance to respond to what each other says. So I don't think we can apply this necessarily to, you know, a real debate format, because there was no back and forth, there was no flow of arguments, there was no resolution on the table, right? But what we can say about the moderators themselves is that, you know, the flack they're getting is that one of the accusations is that they're fact-trumping Trump and not Harris, but that I think it's because Trump was the one making the more predictable claims, right? When you're moderating a debate, you come prepared for a few outcomes, right? You think he might say this, therefore I'm going to say this. And the lies that Trump was challenged on were lies that he's made before, or lies that had already caused controversy online, like the line about Haitian refugees eating cats. That was something that had been causing a splash on the internet for about 4 days now, so the moderators knew that was something to catch him on. When Harris's comments, like, you know, some of her comments on abortion policy, things like that, that could have theoretically been fact checked, they were things that don't necessarily fall into that more splashy thing that the debaters might, I mean, that the moderators might have been prepared for. So I don't think it's really a case of the moderators being biased as much as Trump being predictable.
Well, what do you think about the questions that they asked and the prioritization of issues that they made?
They emphasized a lot of foreign policy questions up front, but I actually think that's the right call. And I know everyone's myopic toward their research area, but I do think that this is an unusually important election for foreign policy. I think that the president, whoever the president is in the next term, is going to face down some of the most dramatic challenges to U.S. leadership in the world. And so I think it's wise the way that they prioritize those issues. I think that they tried to throw each candidate a few questions in their strength areas, and I don't think either candidate capitalized on them. So, you know, they were almost acting as campaign boosters for the candidates, and the candidates were distracted or were following a different debate strategy. Again, I don't want to presume that I completely understand the strategy they were going after, but they didn't. I don't think the moderators were uniquely bad. I do think, in retrospect, obviously there are things that they could have emphasized better. They could have tried. So the whole point of turning off the mics loses all of its meaning when if someone insists you turn their mic back on, right?
And then you turn it back on.
Right, right. And so there are things that in retrospect they could have done better from a craft perspective. I don't think either candidate's performance was a direct consequence of anything the moderators did. And so from that barest level, I think the moderators were fine.
Okay, if we look at what the Harris campaign said after the debate, they said, let's do this again. Now, I don't think we're probably going to see that. But if they did, what advice would you give to both candidates about what the appropriate strategy for them would be?
So one of the fundamental things about debate is that you have to leave your ego behind. You have to be able to participate in the debate in a way where you recognize that the person you're talking to is not your audience. So Trump is not trying to convince Harris, and Harris is not trying to convince Trump. But if all you can see is the person on the other side of the lectern, then you lose sight of the entire purpose of the debate. So I think both of them need to understand that they're communicating with the American people, not to each other or the moderators or some imagined enemy, and give me something to make my decision on as a voter. You know, then obviously, we want to see policy, right? But
right yeah. there. I mean, isn't that common sense, what you just said? So why didn't they do that?
Because they have different thoughts about there's two sides to this. Maybe they're competent and they have different thoughts about what will motivate the American voter than you and I do. That's entirely possible, right? Or it could be that they're lost in their own systems and Trump is full of ego and Harris is trying to score points against the enemy, right? Like that could be the case too. It could be that they're distracted. I think my instinct is to think these are two people on top of very complicated political machines. They probably actually do know what they're doing, and the errors that I think they're making might be just a difference in values. Where I want a world where the politicians stand up and give me policies to decide between and make a rational case for why I should vote for them. But maybe we just don't live in that world.
Well, you would at least hope that they'd have a little bit more well thought out vision for where they want to take the country.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and also, you know, I never thought I'd say this, but I could even do it with a little more ideology. I want them to stand for something. And I don't think in this whole debate, if all I knew of these candidates were what I saw on that stage, I would walk out of there completely confused about what they stand for.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the thing is, I think they actually do stand for stuff for the simple fact that regardless of what the candidates would like to do, they can only do what they can get done.
And sure.
Both the House and Senate are controlled by ideologues. And so whatever they do, it will be further right than most people want or further left than
maybe
most people want.
But I mean, if you look at Harris's stances, she was advocating to the right of, I think, the mainstream of her party. And Trump, he's been making a play for, well, at least at the convention, they were making a play for the more working class vote, for more labor interests, things like that. So I think we could imagine a world where we interpret what they're saying, not even imagine a world, we're in a world where it is possible to interpret what they're doing as some sort of play for stealing voting blocks from each other, which is a moderate play normally. But
I think it might be the idea of stealing voting blocks to win, but I think they're going to revert to the... or what regress to the mean,
but not the median,
and do what the party
maybe
median wants.
I mean, do we know what the Republican Party median wants now?
They don't want Biden.
They got that. They're not going to get Biden.
Right. Right. So, they don't want liberalism. They don't want wokeism. I think.
Yeah, but that's something they're against. Yeah.
But I think that's what the modern Republican Party is more about.
Well,
they know what they're against instead of what they are for.
And I actually, that's about the only way to explain some of the things that Harris did in that debate too, in that the Democrats don't want Trump.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, and what we have seen is he's got very high disapproval, and that most of the strongest partisans are voting against the other person instead of voting for our person. That's what we refer to as negative partisanship.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're just about out of time. Do you have any concluding comments here?
You know, I will say that the entertainment side of debate is, I think, dangerous in this circumstance, because it is fun and it's easy to get swept away in the joy of the back and forth and the insults and things like this. But from a Christian perspective, we know that we are to pray for our leaders. It's hard to pray for someone you're laughing at. And we know that we are to give honor to our leaders, or, you know, as the scriptures would say, the emperor, right? Mm-hmm. It's hard to pay the honor due to the emperor when we don't respect the emperor. And I think what happens after a debate like this is we walk out, no matter who wins, we're not going to respect them. And this is a place where I have to watch myself, where I want to laugh, I want to make fun, I want to you know, join in the fun of laughing at these people. That what I'm functionally saying is, I think that my leaders are idiots. And that's not a position that I think that we should allow ourselves to go as Christians. And that's tough in a debate like this.
Well, and I think also what you're pointing up is the importance of character in our elected officials.
Yeah.
And what we saw a lot of last night, they were trying to divide us instead of bring us together.
Yeah, and that might be good political strategy, but at the end of the day, it makes it harder for me to do what I'm commanded to do, and which is respect them. And the thing is, the scriptures don't say respect them when they're respectable.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm going to go home today, and I'm gonna confess my own sin of not giving them due honor and not praying for them properly, because they make it hard, but it's my job, not theirs. You know.
Right. Right. Well, we both have jobs.
Yes. Well, that's true. That's true.
And I think they need to stand up for their views. And I think also part of the idea is there has to be a certain amount of personal integrity that we want in a politician. So what I'm concerned in our polarized environment is the potential abuse of power. We've talked a lot about how two of the important norms of democracy is mutual tolerance and institutional restraint.
That's right.
And when you attack the other party, it's easier to justify abusing your power because you think it's worth it to prevent the other party from getting in power. And I think that is a problem we face. And so I think part of what it is, yes, we need to pray for leaders. I think we both do it every day. But I think what we also need to pray for is discernment among the public in terms of how they should view this. And I think we should pray that God raise up a better set of leaders for us so that we can move in a much better direction.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your thoughts on this, and I will now yield the remainder of my time.